from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, September the 16th, 2019, and welcome to our program today. We have an excellent one lined up for you, I do believe. And later on in the show, the second hour, we're going to be talking to a couple people from the Vermont Health Department about the recent concerns over vaping and a apparently related serious respiratory illness. Some people are vaping tobacco, THC, other substances in these little electronic cigarette devices, and then getting quite sick. There have been, I believe it's up to 6 deaths nationwide. I don't know of any reported in Vermont yet, although the State Health Department has reported that it has been investigating, I think, 4 cases of people getting sick. One of those cases was found not really to be to make the connection between vaping and respiratory illness. So it's, I guess they're down to 3 as of our last count, although we will assuredly get an update on what the count is in the second hour of today's program. The health department has been asking providers to let them know when they are treating people who appear to have this illness. We're also going to be talking a little later this hour with Garrett Graff, author of a terrific new book out. It is it's basically a oral history. In fact, it's called an oral history of 9/11, and the main title is The Only Plane in the Sky. Garrett Graff did a terrific job of interviewing hundreds of people who were there that day in various aspects of the 9/11 catastrophe, folks who were in the World Trade Center towers, responding to the planes hitting the towers and the unfolding disaster that resulted there, widows and widowers of people who died. Also, he interviewed folks in Washington about the plane that hit the Pentagon and the what was perceived as a very serious threat of a plane flying toward the White House or the U.S. Capitol before it crashed in rural Pennsylvania. And it's a gripping. I was reading over the weekend and ended up staying up way too late one night because I couldn't put it down. And so that is, we're going to be talking to Garrett Graff in the second half hour of this opening hour of the Dave Graham Show here. But my first guest I want to introduce is Dick Sawdick. He was on the program a few weeks ago. He is the chair of the Marlborough College Board of Trustees, and Mr. Sawdick was telling us about a plan to merge Marlborough College, a small liberal arts college in southern Vermont, with the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. A lot of Vermont colleges have been struggling. Some have been closing. 3 closures, I think, announced this year so far. There was just some news over the weekend about a round of layoffs at Middlebury College. And so it seems that the entire higher education system, of course, the Vermont State College is also struggling these days. The entire higher education universe out there is essentially suffering from a lack of students. There just aren't enough young people growing up and wanting to go off to college as there were when in decades previous, and when some of these places were built or expanded. And so we have an interesting case at Marlborough College where the merger proposed between Marlborough and the University of Bridgeport has been called off. They've decided not to do it, and so we asked Dick Sawdick to kind of, the chair of the Marlborough Trustees, to come in and talk to us about that and explain what happened. Dick Sawdick, welcome to the program this morning.
Thank you very much, Dan. Dave, it's great to be here.
And so I guess a simple question, the way to put it, is just what happened?
Well, both sides were in intensive negotiations, and both sides participated intensively. You have to go back, I think, and start out with the dream. The basic idea was to bring this tiny liberal arts college in with a larger university and to give the kids at the university an opportunity to go up the hill to Marlborough in Vermont and experience a fine liberal arts education. And also, perhaps, allow the Marlborough students to go down to Bridgeport, which is basically a professional training school, and take advantage of that. So the idea, the concept was visionary, and it was a terrific idea. I can't get into the details too much because I'm under still a non-disclosure clause. But suffice it to say that we went along and we analyzed it very carefully. And we made a proposal that we thought would be a very good way to keep Marlboro alive and in good shape. And we gave it to the University of Bridgeport folks. They decided that it was sufficiently wide of the mark that they wanted to go down, the path they wanted to go down, that they informed us on Friday the 13th that it was not going to work for them.
And the Marlboro issued a statement the other day, actually, the president of the college, Kevin Quigley. I should back up just a little bit and mention that my recollection of Marlboro, and I did several stories down there as an AP reporter for more than 30 years here in Vermont. I always found it to be a fascinating and kind of wonderful place, actually, and in part because going down there, you got a sense that just from talking to students and so on, very serious academic environment. This is not a lightweight school. And the other aspect of it was really took the Vermont town meeting tradition very seriously, in the sense that the students and the teachers, the staff, the whole college essentially would gather periodically to essentially chart the course of how the school was going to be operating. And so there was this town meeting governance there that was also kind of unique and very, very interesting. And I just found it to be an excellent atmosphere there, and something that I would think Marlboro might want to try to preserve, even if this change were to come about. And sure enough, in this statement from the president, Kevin Quigley, he says, as the smaller institution, Marlboro College was especially determined to protect the integrity of its rigorous, self-directed academic model and self-governed community. Was that part of the issue here, Dick Sadek?
Well, we certainly wanted to be sure that our significant endowment, which we have, was put to that use. And we are extremely proud of the academic program. We have a terrific faculty. We have a very low student-faculty ratio. We would, if we had done this merger, we would have a higher student faculty ratio, but it would still be low by most standards. And we felt that we wanted to preserve it for the long term rather than just kind of going in for a few years and then possibly going down. And therefore, at this point, we expect that we will be looking again. And we certainly have some time, thanks to the fact that we have a healthy balance sheet.
So basically what you're saying, it sounds like, is Marlboro College is essentially looking for new suitors.
Well, we're going to take a look at every opportunity. Mm-hmm. And certainly this is the way small colleges are looking. They're looking to get together with larger ones if it's going to work. But Marlboro is, we really feel very strongly that we want to protect the Marlboro tradition. And that, of course, is primarily around the faculty. And we want to be sure that our faculty gets a fair shake out of any sort of merger that we might do, or any other activities that we might do going forward. We're going to look at the whole a whole range of possibilities at this point.
Was there a concern that the faculty might not be treated as well if this merger would have gone through with the University of Bridgeport?
Well, you never know. I mean, we tried to build that in. We baked that into our offer and the protection of the faculty. And you can't be absolutely certain about any of these things, particularly given the financial stresses. Our financial stress, incidentally, is very similar to that of the other tiny colleges, and that is simply that the number of students available has fallen way off, and so we aren't realizing the kind of money from tuition that we normally would.
Yeah, this is really a tough time for colleges in Vermont. We're going to actually have Jeb Spalding on. He is the chancellor of the Vermont State College System. Of course, that's a public system, different profile from a place like Marlboro. Same issue, though, which is basically not enough kids coming through.
That's right.
And Middlebury College just has announced, or has been carrying out, actually, a round of layoffs. VT Digger had a very interesting story over the weekend where they looked at the way Middlebury is handling the procedure now after some time ago. I think it was the early 90s. There was a sort of a suddenly announced round of layoffs at Middlebury that really upset a lot of people and caused some damage to the sort of mood of the campus for years following. Middlebury, I think, is trying to avoid a repeat of that by handling this situation, they hope, better this time around. Of course, Green Mountain College closing, Southern Vermont College, there was a school in Rutland. College of St. Joseph. Okay, yeah. All actually closing their doors this year. Goddard College in Plainfield has been struggling off and on for years now. And it just seems as though something's got to give here. None of these institutions wants to close. It strikes me that some of them are going to maybe are going to have to.
It's a shame, really, because what you're doing is you're taking out a slice of the educational system that is unique and that harkens back to really close individual teacher-student relationships and independent discussions and decisions as to what studies the students are going to pursue. And, you see that kind of across the board in these colleges, and I would hope that it would stabilize, but we all are being pretty realistic about the likelihood of being able just to wave a wand and expect more kids to show up.
You know, I'm a graduate of two large state universities. I got a bachelor's degree from the University of Mass at Amherst and a master's degree at Ohio State out in Columbus. And the I must say, the times that I would visit the Marlboro College as an AP reporter, I remember thinking, you know, it takes on a little bit of the flavor of the old Agora back in ancient Athens, where Plato was sitting at the knee of Socrates. And because there is that amazing connection that teachers would have with students, not to say that couldn't happen. I mean, I had a couple teachers actually at UMass in particular who I really developed a personal connection with, and that was great. But that seemed to be the norm and kind of the expectation almost at Marlboro more so.
It is absolutely the case. If you talk to most Marlboro alumni, they will single out one or two particularly inspiring teachers who kind of followed their trajectory through college. And, I must say, as a graduate of Harvard, I didn't get so much of that there either.
Yeah. I mean, the bigger places, it's harder to pull off with every student, that's for sure. So, Dick, how did you ascend to this exalted position of being chair of the Marlboro Trustees?
It was nepotism. My roommate at Harvard had become the chair of the Marlboro board, and he asked me to join.
Oh, I see. Okay.
This was many years ago.
Uh-huh. So you'd been serving for a while on the Marlboro trustees, and they decided you could be chair for a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sweet little college, and it is really rewarding to be involved intensively in this, and I must say that we feel that the stakes couldn't be higher. We really have got to work this thing through.
And Marlboro actually has, from what I understand, a pretty strong endowment relative to other small colleges. Is that right?
It does. It has an endowment of about $35 million, and it has debt of about $2 million, which makes its balance sheet a lot stronger than most colleges, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's a nice position to be in if you're a small college or pretty much any enterprise.
Yeah, the problem, though, once again, is the annual expenses versus the revenue that you get from tuition these days. And so when you look out into the future, the endowment gives you real strength and backbone, but it doesn't solve this annual shortfall problem.
Yeah, and one thing about Marlboro, too, is that if I remember correctly, compared to some other campuses, which have all, you know, in the last couple of decades, it seems like a lot of campuses have gone into these building booms where they're building absolutely, you know, super fancy student unions and basketball arenas and et cetera, et cetera. And Marlboro struck me as, you know, as campuses go, a little bit on the rustic side. Is that fair?
Absolutely fair, yeah. We do have some beautiful buildings, and we actually have two under construction that the music festival has is building for us and for our use. And we have some lovely buildings, but you're right. It's kind of eclectic, the architecture, and we build for our own needs and not this big splashy Olympic-sized pools and huge fields and so on. Our major sport is broomball, which only takes a small bit of ice and away you go.
Are you Division I in broomball or
Well, of course we're recruiting in broomball.
Okay.
Anybody down there in high school who is particularly adept at broomball, we'll take a look at.
You might get an athletic scholarship
tomorrow. Well, we'll see.
We'll see about that, yeah. That is funny. Yeah, Marlboro is not known as a powerhouse football or basketball school, folks. That probably is an understatement. But it strikes me as really interesting that I want to talk about actually the music festival and the relationship between the college and the music festival, because obviously they share facilities. The music festival, a venerable institution in and of itself, comes in every summer and brings in, you know, world-class musicians for a series of concerts and teaching and so on. Tell us a little about that and its relationship with the college.
Marlboro College started in 1946. Marlboro Music Festival started in 1951. And there has been a very close relationship over the years between the two. They take over the festival takes over the campus for about 8 weeks in the summer, every summer since 1951. The Marlboro Music Festival is probably the best training for classical musicians in the world. And almost everybody has come out of there. Yo-Yo Ma, Casals used to teach there.
Rudolph Serkin.
Rudolph Serkin, yep, ran,
yep,
it.
Yep.
And right now, Mitsuko Uchida, who is one of the great pianists of our day, is one of the artistic directors, and so on. It is a magnificent organization, and we're very proud to have it. And they have contributed greatly to the campus, and we've worked out a deal with them, which gives them a 99-year lease. And they are building these buildings that I mentioned, which are beautiful buildings. And, you know, it's a good relationship, I think.
That's got to lend some, also some strength. We talked about the endowment, but the music festival has to lend some institutional strength here too, doesn't it?
Yes, they do. Yeah. I think there's no question that they help that in that regard. And we're looking forward to having internships, arts internships, and some possibly master classes that some of the musicians might give to Marlboro students and so on.
Wow. So a little even closer ties possibly as time goes on. And the now, in terms of the future of Marlboro College, are you still thinking, I mean, it sounds like you are, that a merger with the right institution might be in the cards?
Sure. Yes.
And
I mean, now, it was Friday when this one was called off, so we haven't gotten too far down the road yet.
Right.
On today is Monday. But
yeah, we'll sure, say. Sure. A whole new week.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is there a certain style of school or size of school that would be most attractive to Marlboro?
Well, I think in the first place, it would have to be a school that appreciates the Marlboro way of teaching and traditions, mm-hmm. and that would see them as a great value to that school, whether it's big or small. Probably a little bit larger, though. I mean, Marlboro, it wouldn't be hard to get a place that was larger than Marlboro.
Yeah. How many students at Marlboro?
We have about 150.
Right 150. Now. So that is a small college for sure. And, you know, I do think that actually that's part of its charm, is and that's why you have these really close relations between the faculty and the students there, is because it's that small. I mean, that is smaller than most high schools, I think, actually. But
yes.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And in terms of the larger school, you know, I would imagine if I were, I don't know, the let's just say to pick something at random, and I'm not putting any news out there, folks, but suppose Dartmouth College wanted to do something, they might actually say, you know, Marlboro has a special style of teaching that isn't as big a deal at Dartmouth. Students, if you want to take a semester and go down and try that, this is an opportunity, and it would be a fascinating case of a possible partnership there. I mean, obviously, I know nothing about to indicate that would be in the cards. But hey, unfortunately, we are about out of time on this conversation. Richard Sodek, I really want to thank you for coming in this morning and sharing this news with us. And I wish you the best in future endeavors of Marlboro College. It's a great little institution. And
thank you very much.
Alrighty. Hey, we're going to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show. When we return, we're going to be joined by Garrett Graff, author of a terrific new book, The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11. Back shortly, folks.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Tone Code, Fashion Forward, Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and I want to introduce my next guest. Garrett Graff is a Montpelier native, went to Harvard University, and since then has fashioned himself quite an excellent career as a journalist. He was the editor for a while of two prestigious magazines in Washington, Politico Magazine and the Washingtonian. He's written multiple books now, and also many articles and for Wired Magazine, the New York Times, other publications. And he's out with a terrific new book. It's called The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11. It was actually, I guess, released just in the last couple of weeks, right around the anniversary, which, of course, was last Wednesday, the 18th anniversary of that horrific day in American history. And I'm very glad to say that Garrett Graff is my guest this morning. Thanks for joining us, Garrett.
Thanks for having me. I'm pleased to be back.
And you really did quite a great piece of work here. I was reading over the weekend. I haven't made it all the way through the book yet, but I'm making some progress, and it is an amazing piece of work. It seems as though the bulk of it is actually just quoting from interviews with people you talk to, and there seem to be hundreds of them. I mean, you can turn to pretty much any page in the book, and you get a flavor for where was this person, what were they doing on the morning of 9/11, and how did they respond to the events that unfolded then? And this includes everybody from New York City firefighters to Vice President Cheney, and many, many people in between, people in the military, people in the civilian sector. And how long did it take you to put this book together?
So I've been working on the book for about 3 years now, and the final result, as you said, it's the voices of about 480 Americans as they lived that day. And I felt that this was sort of an important way to tell the story of 9/11, which we are sort of all very much familiar with the facts of the day, but particularly, you know, this is now the 18th anniversary of the attacks this month. And I think sort of one of the things that we're beginning to lose, both for those of us who did live through it, and now for an increasing generation, about a quarter of America who has no memory of that day whatsoever. And so my goal for this book was to capture those voices, to explain not just the facts of 9/11, but what 9/11 was like to experience. So this is 9/11 told only through the voices of the people who lived it, morning to night, coast to coast.
Yeah, that is a really great piece of work. I got to tell you, I admire the effort that had to go into this. You had some help. You had a team of folks working on this, right?
Yeah, and this was so the book is a mix of my own oral histories. I collected a couple hundred of my own stories and interviews from people, as well as a lot of archival primary source oral histories done by places like the 9/11 Museum and Memorial in New York, the Pentagon historian, the Capitol Hill historian, the Flight 93 National Memorial. So we sort of went out and collected about 2,000 of those stories. And then, you know, working with another oral historian, I sort of spent about a year trying to sort through that pile down to basically what ends up being the 480 voices in this book. And, you know, the goal was to tell not just the stories that we are most familiar with that day, the Twin Towers, Shanksville, and the Pentagon, but also to tell the story of what was taking place in air traffic control towers, in the cockpits of passenger jets and fighter planes, to talk about what was going on with Vice President Cheney in the bunker under the North Lawn of the White House, what was going on with President Bush aboard Air Force One that day, and then what was taking place with congressional leaders on Capitol Hill that day, as well as news anchors, school children, sort of everyone across the country who sort of felt that day and the effects of it as the attacks rippled across the country. So there are, you know, there are some surprising perspectives as well. You know, the astronaut Frank Culbertson opens the book. He was the one American off the planet Earth on 9/11 aboard the International Space Station. And we sort of start the book and the day listening to him talk about what it was like to watch 9/11 unfold from space.
That was amazing stuff, I got to say. And just the way you initially put it about, I think, I don't have it right in front of me right now, but I'd have to find the page again or whatever. But I think the line was the only American off the planet. And that just makes you, it sort of makes you sit up and take notice and go, wow, that's an interesting fact right there, you know. And so he's up in space and he's looking down, and it's amazing the detail of stuff that he can see. I had no idea that you could determine how many planes were in the air over the whole country, for instance.
Yeah, and he sort of talks about that, you know, the title of the book, The Only Plane in the Sky. And Dave, I should mention just that I'll be at Phoenix Books in Burlington tomorrow night, 7 p.m. Tuesday.
Oh, we were going to get to that, Garrett. Don't worry.
That book. Yeah.
Yeah. Phoenix Books tomorrow night. I shouldn't have interrupted, because this is the plug I did want to mention. In Burlington, Phoenix Books is a terrific bookstore up there. And Garrett Graff is going to be their guest tomorrow night at what time?
7 p.m.
7 p.m., and I'm sure folks who are starting to read this book and are interested in it are going to be lined up out the door there to meet with you and hear about this.
Yeah, and so the title of the book, The Only Plane in the Sky, refers to Air Force One that afternoon, which Frank Culberson is actually able to see from space, amazingly.
Yeah.
And, you know, Air Force One, remember, the president starts his day in Sarasota, Florida, reading to that classroom of students at Emma Booker Elementary School, and then
my pet
rushed
goat
into the air. My pet goat, absolutely, is rushed into the air and sort of spends the morning flying around the southeastern United States as they sort of try to figure out whether it's safe for him to return to Washington. Ultimately, they determine it's not. He ends up heading first to Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, Louisiana, and ultimately to Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska, before late that afternoon when the last plane is grounded in the United States around 3:15 that afternoon, finally beginning his flight back to Washington. And you know, we sort of follow the president pretty closely through that day in the book, because I thought one of the things that was so striking about that day is how the reactions to the day, the surprise, the fear, the confusion, the trauma of that day, is actually pretty similar whether you are a school child or the president of the United States. That sort of as Americans, we had much of the same reaction to that that story, much of the same reaction to that, you know, watching it unfold together on TV that day. And it's really incredible as we realize, you know, just how sort of the president and the nation's leaders were sort of just as confused and fearful and traumatized by that day unfolding as the rest of us were.
Well, maybe even more so, though, don't you think? Because obviously they bear a tremendous amount of responsibility for, you know, protecting the United States of America. It's their jobs to do all that. And I would think that if I am, you actually go into great detail here on the morning that Dick Cheney had, when he was the one who made the decision, not only that they were going to shoot down this last plane heading toward Washington, but then it was determined that the fighter pilots who went up had no weapons. So what were they going to do?
And so you sort of see the confusion around the vice president in the White House. I spoke to Commander Anthony Barnes, who was the director that day of the White House bunker, where the vice president was rushed. Commander Barnes, Navy officer, Navy aviator, has never spoken publicly before and told me for the first time his story of that day and going to Vice President Cheney to get the authority to shoot down hijacked airliners, and how he sort of went back again and again to confirm with the vice president, because he knew just how momentous, just how historic that order was going to be, and he wanted to make sure that there was no ambiguity either with the vice president or with the Pentagon about what they were ordering. And, you know, then, you know, and this is a major part of that whole day, is how the world and the country was really improvising a response. And, you know, that day we were very unprepared, and the fighter planes that were rushed into the sky that morning, for the most part, actually did not have weapons aboard them. And so they were rushed into the air to police the skies with their own planes being basically the only weapon that they had. And so these fighter pilots are being launched on what they understand is a kamikaze mission if they encounter a hijacked plane. And of course, important to sort of remember and give credit, it was the Green Mountain Boys from the Vermont Air National Guard who were among the first plane, the first fighter pilots to get over New York City that day.
Were they armed? Were those planes armed?
I believe that they were. They came in a little bit later.
Okay. But the really gripping stuff was earlier on when it was from Langley or one of the air bases around Washington. These two fighter pilots went up, one of them a woman, and they were basically, they took off saying, and I'd never seen this phrase before, flying Winchestered, which means without weapons.
Yeah, so Winchester meant, is sort of military speak for not having any weapons aboard or being out of weapons.
What? I mean, this is such a terrible day. I know I shouldn't be laughing, but that does strike me as a little bit funny. I used to think of Winchester as a weapon because obviously there's a famous gun manufacturer.
Yeah.
Why? Any idea of the etymology of that term?
I don't remember. It's the one that it's been around for a while, and it's generally meant. In the code were, you know, it's sort of military speak for when you're out of weapons, sort of once you've used all of your weapons.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And sort of need to return to base. You know, there aren't that many times that we're actually putting planes in the sky unmanned. So, so normally you hear sort of planes register, I'm Winchester,
Okay.
You know, once they've completed a mission and are out of weapons.
I see. Yeah. Very, very gripping stuff when these two people are actually saying as they're taking off that, you know, they expect to die, basically. They think that's their mission that day.
And sort of like if their mission is successful, it will be the last time that they ever take off.
Yeah, that's just wow. You know, you kind of go, holy. In fact, that the second word I almost said there and I shouldn't on the air is just I think that was the common expression throughout that day. I remember there was some live coverage on CNN that morning when they had just a guy on the street in New York watching one of the planes hit the buildings, and that was his comment, the holy. And you can guess the second word. But and I saw that elsewhere in your book. Somebody else was saying, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people were saying that day.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of one of the things that stands out for me in the book when you sort of look at it is that, you know, the story that we tell about 9/11 when we go back and remember that day now 18 years later is a much neater and cleaner version of 9/11 than any of us who lived that day actually experienced. You know, the story that we now tell is the first attack started at 8:46 in the morning with the first crash. It was all over 102 minutes later with the collapse of the second tower. In New York City, it's the four planes, it's the Twin Towers, it's the Pentagon, Shanksville. And that's really not the way that any of us experienced 9/11. And that's sort of one of the things that I think is really important to recapture, and that was one of my goals in telling this book in this way, was to make clear to people sort of just how confusing that day really was. I mean, we didn't, you know, well until the late morning and actually early afternoon, there were fears that there might be as many as a dozen other hijacked planes still in the sky. You know, we had very little understanding of when the attacks even began. And in fact, you sort of see that during what to me is the most interesting moment of 9/11, which is the 17 minutes between the first crash and the second crash, where you see sort of just how innocent America actually truly was morning, where sort of people look at that first crash and just think it's weird. You know, no one sort of defaults to thinking it's the beginning of a terrorist attack. And, you know, one of the people that I quote in the book, one of the most amazing quotes to me in the entire book, is a New York ferry captain who talked about witnessing the first crash from New York Harbor. And he continues on with his ferry into Lower Manhattan, and every single one of the commuters gets off at the Wall Street Terminal in Lower Manhattan, even as they are walking into Lower Manhattan amid papers and envelopes fluttering down from the impact of that first plane. That sort of everyone was like, oh, this is just something weird that happens in New York City. You know, it's an aviation accident. A pilot had a heart attack. It was a problem with air traffic control. And that day, you know, it really wasn't until the second crash that anyone in America really began to realize that this was a deliberate act, you know, an attack on our country.
And one of the things about this, I mean, you've emphasized now a few times how no one knew what was coming next as this thing unfolded. And there's an amazing little passage here. I mean, there are many, many passages in here, I think, which carry that message. But one really grabbed me, which is when there were a couple of firefighters who were in the North Tower. Of course, the firefighters all poured down to the scene and were going into the building to try to see whom they could rescue, et cetera. And there's a quote, this is actually in the Around the Towers chapter, page 186. Captain J. Jonas, Ladder 6, Fire Department of New York, FDNY. The emergency power came up and the lights came on. I looked at fellow firefighter Billy Burke and I said, "What was that?" So they hear this noise. They're in the North Tower. They hear this noise. "What was that?" I said, "Billy, you go check the south windows and I'll go check the north windows and we'll meet back here." And he says, "I couldn't see anything when I went to my window. All I could see was white dust pressed against the glass. We met at the stairway, and I expected Billy to tell me that something happened with our building. With a straight face, he looked at me and says, 'The South Tower's collapsed.'" And that is, you know, what a piece of news to be delivered by a colleague right there. You're in the North Tower. And your colleague is telling you that the South Tower just collapsed. Of course, that was the second one hit, but the first one to collapse, correct?
Yes, it was the second one hit and the first to collapse. And, you know, one of the things that is, you know, again, hard for us to remember because we, you know exactly how 9/11 unfolds now, is that there really was almost no expectation that the towers could collapse. You know, before 9/11, no high-rise building had ever collapsed before. And so this was really unprecedented. And the firefighters, you know, who are working their way up the stairwells of that building, you know, they are not thinking that they are working on borrowed time. You know, they are thinking that they sort of have the time to climb up to the crash zone and that, you know, it might take even a couple of days to get the fire out. You know, ultimately, you know, the worst that they are thinking at that point is that the fire might continue burning up and sort of burn up to the tops of the building over the course of, but, you know, no one is thinking until about 9:45, 9:50 that day that the towers could actually fall.
Yeah, it just the whole thing is, I mean, still just a nightmarish set of events that it's hard to believe they could actually happen. And one of the things I want to ask you, Garrett, is the country better prepared now if a group of people from somewhere, anywhere, were to hijack a bunch of airplanes and start flying them into buildings? Would we be better able to respond now?
Yes, and I think in two main ways. One is, you know, and you see this in the fact that Al-Qaeda has not been able to carry out another highly coordinated attack on the homeland like this. But we have just gotten much better on the intelligence and the law enforcement side about picking up and disrupting these complicated plots in advance. So that's sort of the first thing is, you know, it's vastly harder to pull off this type of thing now in the first place. The second is, you know, you would see all sorts of different reactions. You know, the passengers and crew aboard a hijacked plane today, you know, would not react in the way that those sort of first couple of hijacked planes reacted because they would have a better understanding of what the hijackers might actually be trying to do. I mean, remember, you know, the protocols in those early days, you know, before 9/11 were to cooperate with hijackers. There was no sense that the hijackers would be trying to use the planes as weapons themselves. And so, you know, you cooperate with hijackers, you get the plane on the ground somewhere, you figure out what their demands are, you pay the ransom, you know, et cetera, sort of, And then, of course, you know, we now have very developed protocols about how those any hijacked plane approaching a population center would be interdicted and intercepted by U.S. fighters.
There's another thing I have to ask you about, which I'm almost a little reluctant to do, but it is something that is out there, and I want you to address it, because you obviously have taken a fresh look at all of this. And books by people like David Ray Griffin, The New Pearl Harbor, other commentary over time have raised questions about whether there was any kind of complicity in this attack from inside our government. Did your review of this move that needle at all?
So there is actually some truth to a specific part of this, which is the CIA and the FBI simply didn't share information well enough in the year before 9/11. And there are sort of some complicated bureaucratic and legal reasons for why that unfolded. But the CIA did have knowledge that two of those 9/11 hijackers were inside the United States before 9/11. We didn't know why. We didn't know what they were planning. But we knew that they were Al-Qaeda, and we knew that they were inside the United States. And the CIA simply never passed that information along to the FBI. And it is sort of terrible to think about, but you know, it is possible that had the government shared information better, it would have been in more of a position to disrupt the 9/11 attacks, or at least, interdict some of the hijackers themselves.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, just a couple of minutes ago, we have a caller on the line. I hope he can be quick. Jim from Barrie. Good morning, Jim. Jim, were you with us? I guess
not. Oreo Palmer's story.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I wonder if you came across the story of Oreo Palmer, an FDNY battalion chief. He was the only firefighter that made it to the very top, ran up all the stairs. He was a wicked health nut and was well known for running every day, but he made it to the top of the towers before it collapsed. It's just an amazing story. Oreo Palmer, battalion chief, FDNY.
That
ever hear anything about
Garrett?
Absolutely. The heroism of those firefighters in that first hour after the attack is really incredible. And they, not just sort of how far up some of them actually made it, but then also that a number of them refused to evacuate even after the Mayday orders had gone out to leave the towers. Because they felt that they were sort of providing comfort and aid to some of the injured civilians who were stuck in the building, and they didn't want to abandon them, even though they understood that they were making a, ultimately fatal decision to stay in the towers.
All right, Jim, thank you for the call. I really appreciate it. The book is The Only Plane in the Sky. It is an oral history of 9/11. My guest has been its author, Garrett Graff, a Montpelier native, who's gone on to really terrific things in journalism and as a historian nationally known these days. He's a frequent commentator on CNN, and we're really proud to have him on the Dave Graham Show this morning. Thank you so much, Garrett.
Great. Thanks.
And we are going to be heading into a break at the top of the hour here for some CBS News. We'll be back in a few minutes with some commentary from Talk Media News, one of the correspondents who joined us after the mid-show break. And the Dave Graham Show will continue into the second hour. We're going to have a couple folks on from the health department talking about vaping and serious respiratory illness. And stay with us, folks. More to come.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., Fashion Forward, Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back continuing into our second hour this Monday, September the 16th, 2019. And I'm happy to say one of our Talk Media News correspondents joins us this morning. I believe it is Bob Ney on the line. Is that right, Bob?
Yes. Good morning, Dave.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm going on vacation.
I heard.
So I'll be replaced or substituted or something.
Yep. It'll be interesting to see who gets lined up to come on our air with us. It's all of you guys do a good job, and so I'm not too worried.
Thank you.
But I do certainly appreciate when you're here. But I know everybody deserves a vacation now and then, so that's good for
yes,
you.
Yes, sir. Thanks.
Interesting, really kind of disturbing news developments here with this attack on the oil facility in Saudi Arabia, allegedly by Iran, and President Trump tweeting, there is reason to believe we know the culprit. We are locked and loaded, depending on verification. Apparently, they're waiting for some word from Saudi Arabia. And Mike Pompeo, or the Secretary of State, earlier in the day, who identified Iran as the culprit, saying Iran has now launched an unprecedented attack on the world's energy supply. Are we about to go to war with Iran?
Well, I mean, the tensions are high. You know, there's a few things here, I think, that have to be looked at. Number one is the fact that there was a deal about to be signed. It was organized by French President Macron, and it was going to be giving the Iranians $15 billion, and President Trump, as we know, was basically getting on board with that deal. So it's highly suspicious that the Iranians would tell the Houthi, and that's the rebel group from the country of Yemen that Iran backs. It's highly suspicious that Iran would say, yes, go bomb now. It just doesn't make sense, number one. Now, Iran does back the Houthi, who admitted they have done this because there's a proxy war in Yemen. Iran's on one side with the Houthi, and then the Saudi Arabians are on the other side with the other rebel group. So, you know, that's where these two countries are fighting a proxy war. Number two, if anybody is waiting to hear something truthful from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, I mean, this is the king that chopped up a reporter. There's no question he knew that reporter was going to be killed, and they lied all the way through it. I lived in Saudi Arabia. They behead people. They chop people's hands off. You know, they treat people like slaves. And so it's amazing that we will actually take the word for the Saudis. Yeah, the Iranians did it. I'm always suspicious. Look, I'm suspicious of Iran and Saudi Arabia. But also, I'm always suspicious, and I think the press corps should be, when it comes to who really did what in the Mideast. It's hard to say. Now, the other fact, I think, politically, that the president, you know, if the president talks tough, that's cool. That's great with Iran. But he's going to have to watch. If we would go to war with Iran on behalf of the Saudi oil fields, Saudi Arabia's got plenty of jets, plenty of members of the royal family that do nothing but hang around their palaces all day. They can fly their own jets to bomb Iran. I think that'll be the attitude of a lot of American people.
Stay the heck out of it, you mean, as what the United States should do. Well, I'll tell you, Bob, the other thing that's kind of disturbing here, you talked about it, expecting to get the truth out of Iran is a fool's errand. What do we make of this? This is... the president yesterday is saying, the fake news is saying that I'm willing to meet with Iran, no conditions. That is incorrect statement. That is an incorrect statement, as usual. So the fake news getting it wrong. And, of course, this is what the president told NBC's Meet the Press back in June, that he would meet with Iran with, quote, no preconditions. I wonder where the fake news media got the idea that the president would meet with Iran with no preconditions. Do you think maybe from the president?
Well, also, Pompeo said the same exact thing, no conditions.
Yeah.
Pompeo said it. I heard him say it.
Yep.
We've heard the president say it. You know, I don't know why the president, you know, wants to do this. I mean, these are things that, you know, they're right there. They're on the video. It's not like you kind of dance around this or make it a gray area. They definitely said that.
And it's just, I mean, it is kind of a piece, but you do have to point it out when it happens again and again, especially on something as important as a potential war. I mean, this is really, really serious now, folks. And the president wanting to bash the fake news media for reporting what he said a couple months ago just strikes me as unbelievably irresponsible. I mean, it's just really off the charts. It's borderline crazy. I mean, people do talk about the president's mental health. I don't know. I mean, there's the Donald Trump June version, and now there's the Donald Trump September version. Maybe that's what we're dealing with. I don't know. Is it a multiple personality thing? And this is just last week, according to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who says that on Fox News Sunday, the possibility of Trump meeting with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, quote, he has said he'd meet with him with no preconditions. So apparently that was U.S. policy, to meet with Iran with no preconditions as of last week. And now the president is saying it's all fake news.
Right. And it's not. They said it. And, of course, they're all over the place with Iran. Bolton was there guiding it one way. And then the president wisely realized that Bolton was going to get him into war. Now, all of a sudden, Bolton's gone and something else happens. I really hate to even probably say this, but I will. Who's to say the Saudis didn't do this to themselves?
Well, there's that possibility. Or somebody who did it maybe said, hey, John Bolton's gone now. We won't have a war tomorrow. It might take a couple days. So let's go ahead.
Yeah, you never know. Or the Saudis paid somebody $5 million to do it to them. You never know over in the Mideast. Between Iran and Saudi Arabia, put them in a bag and throw it out and see which one you can recognize.
Yikes. Okay. So Iran denied earlier on Sunday U.S. accusations that it was behind the drone attacks, which targeted the world's largest oil processing facility.
Right.
And is it Abqaiq? Am I getting that close? Or Abqaiq?
Abqaiq.
Okay.
That's good enough.
And, and a major oil field at Quraysh in Saudi Arabia the previous day. And now oil prices are starting to spike because this is 5% of the world oil supply. When 5% of your supply disappears, do prices automatically spike, or is that just moneymakers looking to make money?
Look, the prices haven't even hit the distributors yet. It takes a while for this stuff to catch up.
Yeah.
And 11 years in Congress, I can tell you, every time something like this happened where the prices spiked, we dug into it, and the same thing happens all the time. There is so much manipulation to this thing. I mean, why let a good crisis go unmanipulated by an oil company?
Well, it comes down
to manipulation.
Right here on Main Street, I'm pretty sure when I stop for gas after I get done with the show today, the numbers will be higher than they were a couple days ago, shall we say.
And like I said, it hasn't filtered through the system yet to have the impact.
Any excuse.
Right. This is what's been in the tank for a month, So.
Yeah. Yep. Alrighty. Well, the 2020 Democratic candidates weigh in on Kavanaugh, and now the right-wing media are having a field day because apparently the New York Times had a major omission in their initial story about this. Is that right?
Yes. I think that the candidates jumped too fast on this in the zest of, getting out on the record, because I think Beto went out strong and then the rest came along, And there was a male lawyer that said he witnessed Kavanaugh exposing himself to this woman in college, and the New York Times later came back with some additional information that, I guess, allegedly, supposedly, the woman that this was supposed to have happened to said she can't recall this ever happening.
I would think you would recall an incident like this. I mean, this would be...
Yeah, so I think the candidates better be careful, and it's always a little bit better to say, let's, look into this and see the process and what we can find out, because if this is accurate, that was a major omission by the New York Times, major.
Yeah, especially, I guess it's based on a book written by a couple of Times reporters, right?
Yes, I think so. I think that
one would think that that New York Times reporters would be talking to the paper about salient facts of the case are. Because look, if the alleged victim of a crime doesn't remember being the victim of a crime, I think that you got to include that in the story at least, right?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Not a pretty picture for the New York Times on that. And again, that's really unfortunate because they can't mess up like that because
that's terrible.
people are gunning for him, and you know, and you want to be able to. At least I want to be able to, and I hope most people want to be able to basically trust the New York Times as sure. being an honest broker here, and so on and so forth. That mistake is nigh unto inexcusable, if you ask me. If the way it's being reported right now is the way it unfolded, I'm thinking that one is really bad.
It's a real bad one.
Yeah. Bob, and you quote a whole bunch of Democratic candidates, of course, piling on, which is kind of, I don't know, can you imagine a candidate saying, let's see, all this news is breaking on Saturday, Sunday. I'm going to wait a couple of days and see if there's a correction.
They don't. They don't.
And neither party would they do that. Would they, if something looked bad for, you know, the sort of Democratic side, would Republicans wait and say, well, let's see if there's a correction in a couple of days?
It's sort of like when one media outlet finds out something and the other three find it out and they all run.
First. Sometimes I think it's not really fake news so much as it's kind of hyperactive news. That's the
hyperactive news.
Yeah,
right.
something like that. We have a caller on the line. Do you have a minute to take a call, Bob?
Yes, sir.
Alrighty, let's go to John from Cornwall. Good morning, John.
Hi there. How are you all?
All right. How you doing?
Hello. Good. Hey, just wanted to say something about the New York Times issue. So, two things can be true at once: that the Times omitted something that was important, and we can focus on the other accusation, which was actually the major part of the story, Ms. Ramirez, who does remember Brett Kavanaugh doing it, and there were contemporary folks to whom, you know, she told contemporaneously that it happened. Furthermore, many of those people came to the FBI, and the FBI said to them, we think you're credible, but we've basically been told by the Republican leadership, led by Donald Trump, Attorney General and so forth, that we can't talk to you. So, you know, two things can be true at once.
That is true.
Interesting.
But Ms. Ramirez, I thought, was the one who's now saying she doesn't remember this.
No, it's the other one.
It's the other one. Okay.
I'm confused.
Two accusations. There was a new one that came up, and there's also a reason, if anybody here listening is into college or knows somebody who's gone to college, you know, you're saying, why wouldn't you remember that? It's a shame that people get very drunk in college and black out. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly a reason why somebody wouldn't remember something so horrible. So, mm-hmm. I just want to
remember,
two things can be true at once, that he did this kind of stuff a lot at Yale. There's lots of evidence. And the Times screwed up on a part of the story.
Uh-huh.
Got it. Okay.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting perspective. I thank you, John, for the call. Bob, I suspect we've about run you out of time. Is that true?
Just about, but I've enjoyed it.
All righty. Well, thank you very much for the call, and have a great vacation.
Thank you. Okay.
We'll talk when you get back. Two folks from the Vermont Department of Health are going to be talking to us about a serious problem that has cropped up in connection with vaping. Vaping is a sort of recent years, method for ingesting various substances, including nicotine and THC, the active ingredient in marijuana. And the problem is that in recent weeks, there have been a lot of news reports from around the country of people getting seriously ill, developing serious respiratory ailment related to vaping. Six people, I believe the count is up to now nationwide, have died. And I believe it's hundreds who've fallen ill from this issue. Here in Vermont, the health department put out an advisory to healthcare providers a couple of weeks ago, asking if you have any cases like this, please tell us about them. We want to start tracking them. And I've got a couple of people from the Vermont Health Department on with us this morning. Patsy Kelso is the state epidemiologist, and Rhonda Williams is the chronic disease prevention chief. And the two of them joining me by phone from Health Department headquarters in Burlington this morning. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
And I guess I'll start with whoever wants to go first, actually. Give us the update now. How many cases in Vermont have you investigated? How many are looking like they are, in fact, vaping-related respiratory illness?
Hi, this is Patsy. We've had reports of 11 possible cases, and we've been investigating those. Some of those investigations are ongoing, so five are still pending classification. Mm-hmm. And we've determined that five are not a case, and there is one confirmed case in Vermont.
Okay, so 11 investigations, one confirmed case. And in terms of that confirmed case, is the person still ill and hospitalized, or what's happening with that case?
We can't provide any details about individual cases. I can just tell you that we've had one confirmed case.
I see. And are you surprised that it's only one so far? Were you expecting more, or how does this kind of fit the picture, which may have arisen from expectations?
I wouldn't be surprised if we saw additional cases. We still have the five that we are investigating. It takes quite a bit of epidemiologic sleuthing to sort out whether these possible cases are cases. There's a case definition that CDC is using so that nationwide all the states are counting the same things. So when we hear about a possible case, we need to not only interview the case themselves or a proxy and get information about their symptoms and their onset and the types of products they used and how they used them, but we also do a medical chart abstraction and get more detailed information about their lab findings, chest x-rays, CT scans, other tests that they've had done. And based on information from both of those, the interview with the patient and the medical chart review, we determine if it meets the CDC case definition. And again, that's just so that states across the country are reporting similar things and using the same criteria. So we're still investigating five, and I wouldn't be surprised if we had additional reports as well.
I see. And how long do these investigations typically take? So it sounds like there's a process where somebody comes in and is reported as having sort of entry criteria, has vaped and is sick, maybe. And then you got to figure out, is this really a case or not? How long does that process take?
Yeah, that's basically the process. And it typically takes at least a few days. Some are taking longer. When we hear about possible cases, they're often in the emergency department or admitted to the hospital. Sometimes they're in the ICU. We have to reach out to them if they're able to speak with us and schedule time to do that. We try to do that in person with a public health nurse, for example, going to the facility to sit with the person. It's quite a long interview form because it asks for lots of detail about vaping behaviors and products and devices. So, that can take a couple days if the person is able to talk. And then getting access to the medical record and having time to sit and go through that also can take a day or two. And sometimes people haven't had all of the tests yet. Part of the case definition is that there has to be no known infectious disease cause for their illness. We need to rule that out because that's not part of this syndrome that we're seeing. So if they haven't had some of their test results come back yet, we have to wait for those results.
So you're trying to rule out, say, a viral pneumonia or something like that?
Exactly.
Yeah, and obviously, I suppose on another topic, we just had a caller telling us that two things can be true at the same time. Is it possible that some patients might present who actually have a viral pneumonia and also may have co-occurring vaping-related respiratory disease?
It sure is, and that's accounted for in these CDC case definitions. If a case is going to be called a confirmed case, then they don't have any infectious disease process, but they can be called a probable case if they do have some kind of infection, but the clinical team believes that the infection is not the main cause of their underlying respiratory illness.
Got it. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Bill in Randolph. Good morning, Bill.
Hi. I wanted to do a comment about Oriole Palmer. He was a marathon athlete. a fireman at New York City Fire Department.
Right.
And he took the elevator to the 40th floor, and then he climbed with all that gear to the 78th floor, which was the impact zone. And he said, I can knock this fire down with two hoses. And of course, several minutes after that, I guess, and there was access to above the impact zone. And there's several factors here that should be mentioned. One, he knew that never before and never since, because there's 1,000 degrees difference in what fire can do from even jet fuel,
yeah,
and the temperatures that'll damage steel. It's probably
Bill, I got to interrupt you. Unfortunately, you're talking about a segment that we had on about 45 minutes ago when author Garrett Graff was with us talking about his book, Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11. And obviously, fascinating stuff, but we've kind of changed the topic now, and I've got a couple people on from the health department talking about respiratory illness related to vaping. So I'm going to shift back to that, if you don't mind, but I thank you for the call, and if you can sneak it in maybe while the guest talking about the topic is still on, that would be even that much better, but I appreciate it very much. Alrighty, wanted to get back to my guests, Rhonda Williams of the Health Department, also Patsy Kelso. We've been talking about, as I mentioned, vaping-related respiratory illness. And we have a break coming at the bottom of the hour, and I want to get into some discussion about prevention and so on with you, Rhonda. Maybe after that we're going to be talking to some, or hearing for some, a little bit, minute or so of CBS News and a couple of commercials. I hope you both can stay with us. But Patsy, what are the current stats nationwide? How many cases have we seen? Is it 6 deaths right now?
It's still 6 deaths. The CDC is only updating the national data on its public website once a week.
I see.
So the most recent data we have is from September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, we stood at 380 cases, either confirmed or probable, in 36 different states and the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Got it. Okay. Got to go to a break. I hope you two will stay with us until we get back. Stay with us, folks. We're going to be back with Patsy Kelso and Rhonda Williams of the Health Department in just a couple minutes.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Code, fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back. We are talking about vaping-related respiratory illness. And have two people from the Vermont Department of Health with me this morning. Rhonda Williams is the Chronic Disease Prevention Chief, and the Patsy Kelso is the state epidemiologist. And Rhonda, I wanted to shift our focus to you for a moment and ask you to tell us something about prevention here. Vaping is... it's advertised, in the case of vaping tobacco anyway, or vaping nicotine, I guess, is as safer than smoking cigarettes. Do you buy that?
So the I think we can all agree that there are components to vaping that have been safer than combustible cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that for a while. However, the products have not ever been deemed safe. They're not reviewed by the FDA, and the health department has been really, I think, progressive and proactive with many community members and grantees working on the ground to make sure that people realize that while safer or has been safer or at least thought as safer than a combustible cigarette, these are not safe products. And hence why it's very important for people to know that if they are vaping to stop. And if they haven't been vaping, certainly not to start.
I guess maybe the phrase should be less unsafe. Is that a fair way to put it? In terms of when we compare vaping to combustible cigarettes, vaping might be called less unsafe.
In the current climate, while the investigation is underway, mm-hmm. it's really important to realize that there's so much unknown and still a lot to figure out about the could be multiple reasons for the outbreak. Among the hundreds of thousands of products and flavorings, just to mention a few. So really the primary message right now is for families and parents and teachers to be having the conversation around vaping and the importance of stopping to reduce risk of one of these untoward events happening in their community.
Yeah. Obviously the safest course is don't vape at all. Don't smoke at all. That's the healthy way to go. And I know that there's a lot of work done in dealing with all different kinds of drugs. And I don't know if you agree with me, but I've always considered things like nicotine and alcohol, even though they're legal, they are drugs. Maybe nicotine isn't intoxicating to the degree alcohol is, but they are mind-altering drugs to some extent, and they are, and so people talk about harm reduction in relation to all different kinds of drugs, and so I guess that's one of that's the pitch that the vaping people like Juul, one of the manufacturers of e-cigarettes, have been making about that if you're a smoker. And they claim they're only selling to smokers, which I think most people regard as a little thin, shall we say. But Juul is saying if you're a smoker, this is a way to get away from some of the carcinogens in a combustible cigarette. Does that make sense to you? I know the message you want to get out is don't do it at all. But in terms of harm reduction, does that claim make sense?
Well, fortunately, we have a really strong network of providers, from primary care physicians to nurses and specialists and many others who are prepared and have really effective tools to help people to quit for harm reduction. Mm-hmm. And a health advisory is going out today for providers to have the latest information about the investigation and how they can systematically work with every patient in front of them from youth to those who are older Vermonters. It's really important to ask every patient about their tobacco use and importantly about vaping, and to advise those that use or vape to quit, and that providers are so influential in helping people to quit. There are also other resources available, including 802 Quits that the state provides. It's 24/7. There are multiple ways for people to find what they're looking for that can complement what a provider is doing or help to fill in while in between visits. But until e-cigarette products are submitted by the industry for FDA review and approval as an effective cessation tool, which may happen someday, but it's really important to realize it hasn't happened yet. And so to look and use what is effective and safe is available, free, and easily accessible in Vermont.
Yeah, that sounds like a much better way to go. If you're saying to yourself, I'm a cigarette smoker and I want to quit cigarettes, much better than going to an e-cigarette is the idea of calling 802 Quits. What is the full number there?
The easiest way to remember it is 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Okay,
Got it.
And like I mentioned, that is accessible. There's quit coaches available 24/7. Anyone who lives in Vermont.
Wow. So that is a good service, and that's where to go, folks. First, if you're a smoker and you want to give it up, preferable to e-cigarettes. Patsy Kelso, I want to ask you a question about the occurrence of this disease in connection with different substances. And it goes like this. E-cigarettes are being used these days both to ingest nicotine sort of part of the traditional tobacco habit many people have had. And then the other thing that they're using it for is to ingest THC oil, which gives you a high like marijuana. Like THC is the active ingredient in marijuana. And is there any sense from the CDC or anywhere else telling us which of these two tracks, the nicotine or the THC, has been more a source of this vaping-related respiratory illness?
What we know right now is that about 80% of the cases across the country have used THC-containing liquids.
Mm-hmm.
A smaller proportion have used THC and nicotine both, and then a small percent have used just nicotine.
So it is possible, apparently, to get this disease from vaping nicotine. Is that right?
It could be. The investigation is ongoing. It may be that some of the nicotine products contain whatever is causing this illness.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be, for example, that people who initially report using only nicotine just haven't admitted to using THC.
I see.
There's still so many things we don't know, including, you know, what one product or multiple products are associated with this illness.
So it sounds like the bulk, though, of these cases have been related to smoking or to vaping THC as opposed to nicotine. And I saw a story in the New York Times over the weekend talking about a pair of brothers in Wisconsin who were busted for the making e-cigarettes with the cartridges for e-cigarettes with nicotine, or I'm sorry, with THC, and they were cutting it because I guess the theory and they expressed in the article was that THC oil itself is pretty expensive, and so if you cut it, you're a manufacturer of these things. As somebody was quoted saying, you double your money. And is anybody out with a suggestion for, here is something you can cut it with, folks? And again, this goes into harm reduction more than, I know your idea would be nobody vapes THC and nobody vape nicotine. Assuming that's not going to be the condition of the country anytime soon, then you have to start asking, well, okay, if people are actually going to do some of this stuff, are there substances with which you can cut THC oil which are better than whatever is or which have been deemed safe at all?
So one of the challenges here is that since these products haven't been reviewed and approved by the FDA and they're not regulated, we don't know really what is in these liquids.
Wow.
Especially when we read stories like the one, and I read that same story from the New York Times this weekend. These are, you know, sometimes made by individuals in their homes or in a garage. You can't really be sure what's in these products. And so there's been a lot of reporting in the media about vitamin E acetate, and perhaps that is the cause. As you mm-hmm. said, that is, vitamin E acetate is an oil that is used in many of the THC liquids to cut the THC content and reduce costs for the producer. And weaken the strength of the THC. And, you know, there's really no way to know how much THC versus vitamin E acetate versus something else is in the product.
And is it assumed that a person needs to have some sort of precondition or susceptibility to this respiratory illness? I mean, in other words, are there some people out there who have used vitamin E acetate laced THC oil and vaped it and not gotten sick?
Quite possibly. We haven't done a national case control study or other epidemiologic study to really find that out. I suspect that's true.
I would think the industry would have some kind of a, I don't know. I mean, if the government is going to be slow to do this, I don't expect the government anytime soon to be sort of giving the its imprimatur to a THC based product. The federal government, of course, still outlaws marijuana, and I just can't imagine that's going to be tops on the FDA's agenda anytime soon. Tobacco or nicotine, I'm not sure whether that's really that much higher. It seems as though maybe the industry would need some kind of a lab setting standards and saying, you know, this stuff has been approved by whatever association of vape makers or something. Would that help to address some of these problems?
Certainly, having ideally a federal review for product safety, including what you're talking about of safe ingredients or liquids to cut a product for use, would be the ideal.
Yeah.
Some people also may not realize or do realize and don't know where to go for treatment for being addicted to marijuana. So just for those that might be in that situation, it is easy to find a provider in Vermont. You can call 211 for information, or you can also go to the healthvermont.gov webpage and find a treatment. You can just search that or go to the webpage that is healthvermont.gov/find-treatment. So those are several very accessible ways to go that route if someone is searching for that.
Yeah, and again, I think the preferred position here, folks, is stay away from nicotine, stay away from marijuana, THC. That's the healthiest path, but other paths are being taken, and I think that's the difficulty for a health professional who has to deal with sort of what's really out there on the ground, on the street, however you want to describe it. And so that's why I'm asking some of these questions this morning, is that sort of middle ground there of, as we talked about, harm reduction. Obviously, when you see people dying of vaping-related respiratory illness, that's pretty much the ultimate harm, and we certainly don't want that happening anywhere. It hasn't happened apparently yet in Vermont, but doesn't mean that it isn't possible. My guests are Patsy Kelso, the state epidemiologist with the Vermont Department of Health, and the chronic disease prevention specialist Rhonda Williams, and we are talking about vaping and its connection with a very serious illness that has killed some people, I guess 6 people now around the country, and has sickened quite a number of others. I guess the last number reported by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last week was about 380 folks taken ill around the country. And there's an investigation going on. A lot of this information that these folks are getting is still not completely nailed down, but it looks like there are some products in these vaping products that are being put out, mostly on the THC side, perhaps some on the nicotine side as well, which are cause, or at least a big contributor to these respiratory illnesses. And it's not a happy thing when we have to report something like this. Now, is it possible? It sounded like it's possible from our earlier discussion, Patsy and Rhonda, that pretty much all of this is tied to THC as opposed to nicotine. And is it possible to narrow down a source? I mean, for instance, is there one manufacturer out there of a THC product that has been where the batch has been contaminated or something like that? You occasionally hear this with broccoli or lettuce or something, that a particular truckload or even crop of vegetables on a farm, and they get out into national distribution, and you end up with product recalls and the like. Could that be the ultimate development in the way this situation goes?
It could be. I don't want us to get ahead of ourselves, though, and that's why the national investigation and here in Vermont is ongoing. That's why the case interview form is so lengthy, because we're asking about every single product and how it's used and where it's obtained and whether it's mixed with anything else. And so it's just going to take a while. You know, with a handful of cases in Vermont, we wouldn't be able to sort that kind of thing out. But with close to 400 cases across the country, once they get all the data to CDC and they're able to look at trends and things like that, you know, we're hoping that sooner than later they'll be able to say that these risks are associated with particular products and not others. But we're not there yet.
Yeah.
What we're also seeing with these cases nationally is these are, you know, you asked about predisposing conditions to this outcome, this mm-hmm. severe illness, and we haven't really seen that either. These cases range in age from people in their teens to older folks, mm-hmm. and there's not one underlying condition. Like, we're not seeing that all of them have a history of asthma, for example.
Right, right.
Many of these are previously healthy people. Some of them have smoked vaped for, you know, over a year or many months, while others have more recently taken it up. So there's no apparent trend there. And the illness onset tends to progress pretty quickly over, you know, a week or just several days from going from being relatively healthy to cough, shortness of breath, and then, you know, crashing pretty quickly in some cases and needing to be on a ventilator.
Wow. Not a happy situation at all. I hope... I hear from what you're saying, there's a lot of sleuth work, a lot of detective work in epidemiology. I hope that folks get to the bottom of this pretty quickly and are able to get the country past this health crisis, and maybe what needs to happen is people just need to give up vaping or not start vaping. One outcome or the other is what's needed, I suspect. I want to thank the two of you, Patsy Kelso, the state epidemiologist, Rhonda Williams, the chronic disease prevention chief with the state Vermont Health Department. It's been a very informative conversation, and I thank you so much for joining me this morning.
You're welcome. Thank
you. Alrighty. I wanted to turn our attention the last few minutes of the Dave Graham Show. A couple things, just a sort of general announcements here for you listeners out there. One is I meant to mention our podcast. If you missed part of our conversation with Patsy Kelso and Rhonda Williams of the Health Department about vaping, tobacco-related illness, you'll be able to find it, I suspect, later on anyway. Today, this afternoon, we usually get our shows up later on the same day, and you'll be able to go on and listen to the latest advice from our state health department about this issue. You go to wdevradio.com, that's the website for our station here, and then follow the link from that homepage to the Dave Graham Show. If you scroll down a bit, you'll come up with a list of our recent programs, guests, topics, etc., and be able to listen to anything you like. I know a lot of people are busy between 9 and 11 a.m. on weekdays when we air live, and so it's good that we have that podcast to allow folks to get caught up. I want to thank the Warren Store, the sponsor of our podcast, the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store, for their help in sponsoring that podcast. People tell me it's an important service. I know folks who are working during the day, and they don't get a chance to listen to the radio in the morning, and the comment comes to me sometimes, like somebody says, well, I listen to it while I'm cooking dinner after work. So I'm glad to hear that we have listeners at many different times a day, apparently, And that's all aided by our podcast. So that's that is a good service. I'm glad to offer that. One other thing I wanted to mention was that we're going to be doing a little bit of customer service type of work tomorrow, I think, on the latter part of the Dave Graham Show, that running from, say, 10:15 to 11 o'clock or so. Webster Phillips, a longtime employee of the National Social Security Administration. I'm told he started out in customer service, ended up as the congressional liaison, so from the executive branch agency, going to testify to congressional committees about goings-on with Social Security. He's now with an association, the National Association for the Preservation of Social Security and Medicare, and the Webster Phillips will be our guest tomorrow. And this is an opportunity, I think, for listeners out there who may have questions about their own Social Security, when it's best to apply, what the process looks like, how long it takes, and who you need to talk to, et cetera, to start collecting those benefits when the time comes. Webster Phillips will be our guest and be able to answer all sorts of questions about that. So get them ready, listeners, and don't forget to call us tomorrow with your questions for that nationally known expert on how Social Security works. That's going to be, I think, a real public service show, and I'm hoping it'll generate a lot of calls. That is about it for today's program on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM, and I really appreciate all of you tuning in. And join us again tomorrow. We are on every day, 9 to 11 weekdays, and glad to have you with us. We'll be talking tomorrow.